Jack Rusicki. I'm 17 years old. Today is March 3rd, and I'm speaking with my dad, Mike Rusicki. We are referring to his dad, Chester Rusicki, who is a World War II veteran. This is being recorded, and only my teacher is going to hear it. So to start off, when was your dad born, and what was his childhood like?
He was born in February 12th of 1916, sorry. And he was born in the city of Chicago. His parents actually were, his dad was of Russian descent, and his mom was Polish descent, and they were both born in Russia and Poland and had moved to Chicago. And they were married in 1911. Anyway, so he was the third child of that family. There was a Joseph ahead of him, a Teresa, him, and then another Leonard. So he was born about 5 years after they were married. He ended up going to Austin High School in the Austin neighborhood. And the highest grade he actually completed was ninth grade. And for whatever reason, not necessarily known at this time, that he ended up completing freshman year in high school and ended up going to work for several years. We think it might have been that his dad was sick and he had to help make money for the family. He was worked at Monarch Silver King, which basically made bicycle frames and parts, and he worked for drill presses and punch presses and milling and reading blueprints and things like that. As a side note, around this time in 1941 is when Pearl Harbor was attacked. So this was all starting to, the war in Europe was starting to blossom at this point. About a month after Pearl Harbor was attacked, he married a woman named Elsie Topaz, and she was about 5 years older than him actually at the time. So he was almost 25 and she was almost 30 at the time. And then approximately about a year after they got married, his wife died during the childbirth procedure, and the son, was called Richard, also died the next day. So it was kind of a traumatic experience for him in his life when obviously he was 26 years old and he had just gotten married the year before, and then he lost his wife and child during childbirth. So it was a tough time for him, and at that point I think the war was starting to ramp up quite a bit, and we believe he enlisted in the Army because he was at the time 26, so he was probably a little bit older than most of the guys getting drafted in the Army. But obviously we think it was because he was kind of on his own and wanted to, fight for his country.
All right. Can you tell me a little bit about how his parents might have reacted to his enlistment into the Army?
Well, I never obviously met his dad. His dad actually died about a year after he enlisted. We don't know what from, but we do know that he was sick for a while. My dad's mom ended up living until 1977, but unfortunately we never really had a chance to talk to her too much about, her son going off to war and enlisting in the war back 30 years before that. So it was just kind of speculation that I'm sure she was very concerned for him and very worried for him. So it's, she was healthy and happy until 1977 when she passed. I'm sure he was just very patriotic, like a lot of people were at that time, just trying to help the country and however they could, as well as he was probably still in anguish over his wife and son dying.
Now on to more the war side, what branch of the military was he enlisted into?
He was in the Army, and he was part of the 3rd Armored Division, also called the Spearhead Division, which is part of the 33rd Armored Regiment, I guess. He was in Company B, and he was a private first class. unfortunately, a lot of this stuff we weren't able to kind of go over with him when he was alive. He basically was a very quiet person and didn't like to talk about his past much. A lot of the stuff that I'm talking about here is stuff that we were able to piece together. I'm talking to my mom later in her later years, as well as all the documentation we have about his life. So it's not as much of a firsthand event that we'd like to be able to talk about, but this is, you know, kind of what we had to work with.
All right. What did he do in the military, and where did he do it? Like, what Army base was he stationed at?
Okay. Originally, when he went to basic training, when he enlisted, he went to Fort Knox, Kentucky. And I also believe he spent some time at Camp Beauregard, Louisiana. He was in the U.S. training for about 14 months before he headed to Europe. And then he was then he trained in Europe for, I believe, another 10 months before he ended up seeing any combat. He ended up, he was departed for they call it the EAME, which is the Europe, Africa, Middle Eastern Theater. So he ended up traveling, leaving the U.S. and heading to Europe on September 5th, 2043, and got there 10 days later. So the trip or the time on the ship was probably approximately 10 days.
All right. So
what did he do that? What did he do when he got there?
Yeah, yeah. Do you know how long he was stationed there before he was actually set out for an actual battle?
Yeah, let's see. Well, I think he was on for, he was training there in Europe for another 10 months after he got there. And then he ended up, for a part of his time, he was drove a half-track vehicle for the first 19 months or so, along with mounting field equipment and made repairs in the field or base camp. During his previous life, he was more of a kind of a mechanic or handyman, a lot of machinist type thing. So I think he was pretty handy around machines, and that's what he was primarily doing when he was starting there in Europe. And then he eventually became a medium tank crewman for 15 months, with the final 2 months of his history there when he was in battle. At that point, he was a cannoneer crewman on an M4 tank crew. He was responsible for inspecting ammunition and loading 75 millimeter cannons and 30 caliber light machine guns. And he assisted in the cleaning and maintaining of the weapons and stuff. So he was basically there on the front lines, I guess, working with on a tank crew towards the end.
Do you know when he first experienced the battle?
From what we can tell, he, I guess that the actual D-Day invasion at Normandy was June 6th, 1944. And we know that he fought in two battles, and one was in Normandy and the other later in northern France. But I don't believe he was on the front lines of the Normandy battle when they originally kind of stormed the beach. I believe he came in, you know, shortly thereafter, or days or a week or whatever, and he ended up fighting, you know, in that battle, I guess, as a backup or follow-up to the initial, you know, carnage that was happening on the beach. And then eventually he was fighting in northern France approximately 2 months later, on August 2nd, when he was walking alongside a tank as they were, you know, traveling through enemy area, and the tank and was attacked, and I believe a hand grenade or bomb, something went off near him, and hot shrapnel from the bomb, you know, kind of penetrated his right ankle, and he was basically, you know, rendered, you know, unavailable to fight anymore because his ankle was ripped up. So he was taken to the 106th Evacuation Hospital, and then the 96th, then the 52nd, and the 33rd, and he ended up recovering. It took him 3 months of hospital stays to recover, And to this day, or to this day, till the day he died, he ended up having some major problems with, he was limping for the most part, and he was had some major ankle problems that he was not able to kind of live a normal life. So he ended up, after 3 months recovery, he ended up leaving France and arrived on a 17-day boat trip back to Charleston, South Carolina. And then for another 8 days, he was in another hospital. So it was probably 5 to 6 months worth of time that he was kind of laid up in hospitals where he, you know, wasn't able to do much. He ended up kind of coming back into society, I guess, back in around December of 1945. And it turned out in all, he ended up serving like 3 years, 6 months, and 1 week after he enlisted. And really the last 2 months of those 3 years, 6 months is really where he was in battle, and it didn't obviously take long for him to get injured and incapacitated to be able to keep fighting.
Do you know if he ever wanted to join again after being released due to the injury, or did he, or was he done with it and he didn't want anything else to do with it?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that he was not happy about, you know, wanting to go back and take more of the bloodshed that he had occurred. He ended up, when he was released or whenever he was let out of the army with a discharge, he was an honorable discharge, obviously, and he was given a Purple Heart, which I believe is a sign of being injured in war, wartime injury. And it was, you know, kind of a proud thing for us to all have and know that he did as much as he could for his country while he was there. We had the Purple Heart here today, and it's something, you know, I take pride in him, you know, achieving for his country.
Any chance to know if he ever wrote letters home to his family while he was over in Europe?
You know, we've not seen any of those. You know, there's a chance he could have done it, but he wasn't much of a communicator type kind of guy. He was pretty to himself and pretty quiet. Maybe he wrote some to his mom, possibly, or, you know, obviously there's really no evidence he even came home for his dad's funeral, you know, a year after he got into the service, but I guess he wasn't in Europe yet, so maybe he was allowed to come home for his dad's services. So I guess we may never know.
All right. On the lighter side of things, did he ever talk about any hobbies or activities he did during the war, or possibly how he entertained himself?
No, I think he was always a big baseball fan, and I think we have some photos and stuff of him, you know, throwing baseballs around or whatever, playing catch with his buddies. I do know that he used to smoke all the time, so I'm sure that was one of his reliefs, that he would, you know, smoke cigarettes while he, you know, was passing the time, which, you know, eventually caused, you know, part of the health problems he had eventually that, you know, led to his eventual death. So I don't necessarily know of any other things aside from that. Baseball was really his favorite sport, and that's why it became my favorite sport too, over the years.
All right. You know what the food was like there, if they had to ration a lot of it out, if anything was enjoyable or not?
From what I've heard from him, basically is just, it was, you know, pretty crummy food. It was there in cans and, you know, sea rations, I think they were called. And it was, you know, it was just kind of just eating to survive, not really eating to taste good food. It was pretty poor, especially maybe in the training it wasn't so bad, but in the battlefields, I'm sure it wasn't very good. So, and then he, you know, when he got back, he was obviously enough, he was mobile enough to work and find work. He ended up going back to work at that same company that he was at before that, called Monarch, which they were then selling chainsaws. And it was there that he met a guy named Mr. Allen, who he worked for many, many years after his death, kind of as a handyman, because this Mr. Allen had a lot of different businesses. So he was able to you know, just kind of use his skills, kind of all around skills with machinery and things like that to kind of help out this guy.
Do you know when he started his family after the war? Did he take some time off for himself to regain his thoughts after all the things that had happened?
Yeah, he, you know, obviously right before he went in, 3 months before he went in, he lost his wife and baby, and he came back after, you know, 3.5 years. It turns out where he kind of worked for approximately 10 years before he ended up meeting my mom, Lucille Rose Bradke, and it was almost 10 years to the, you know, the month that he came back, and apparently they had a relatively short courtship, and I think he met her at work. And I think they dated only, you know, 3 or 4 months before they got married. And they ended up about a year or so later after they got married, they ended up having my oldest sister, Barb. And then approximately another year after that, they had my middle sister, Pam. And then another year and a half after that, they had me in the end of 1959. And at the time, he was... 43 years old or so when he had me. I was kind of older, you know, generally at that point. These people used to get married a lot earlier, but obviously he had his situation with his first wife passing and then the war and then the 10 years of delay. So by the time I knew him, or as I got old enough, he was limping around pretty good with his foot. And he would never seem to be very happy. He was always just kind of a quiet man that was kind of just dealing with his own stuff. And we didn't realize how apparently bad his ankle was hurting him. He wouldn't, you know, he's a guy who wouldn't complain about it. It turns out my sisters never even saw his wound. And one time I saw it, and it was pretty bad. He always used to wear socks. Even when he had shorts on, he'd wear socks above that would go well above his ankle. And he ended up, you know, apparently really having some major trouble with that wound for many years. He also was smoking for all these time too, so it turned out that the smoking helped cause circulation problems. And towards the end there, he was getting extremely sick, and I was this about when I was my 19, 20 years old type thing. He ended up going in for a surgery to try to fix the circulation in that leg, particularly in his right leg, and he was basically getting gangrene on his foot and his toe. So he went into a surgery at our local McHenry Hospital where he used to live in 1980. It's called vein surgery of some sort. And it turned out where the foot did not, or the surgery did not work very well. So he was basically released, you know, a week or 10 days later. And the plan was basically to cut his leg off at the knee. At that point, I was at U of I down in Champaign myself. And I remember my mom calling me, crying and pleading with me to get my stubborn father to go back to the Veterans Hospital for a second opinion, you know, possibly attempt another surgery. But for years he was very negative on the military medical care that he got, you know, overseas and even when he came back, so he really didn't want to go. But for whatever reason, I was able to talk him into going to the Veterans Hospital in North Chicago. And, you know, he eventually agreed to do it. He went in and they took one look at him and said, you know, oh, we get these things all the time. This is no problem. Schedule the surgery. And, you know, shortly thereafter, he was out and he was feeling better than he had in 10 or 15 years. He was happy. He was moving around. He was joyful. He was smiling. No one could believe how different he was for that time period. Primarily based on his, you know, his health and his no longer having pain in his ankle. So obviously the injury and the war really affected his ability to you know, enjoy life. So for 6 months During that time, he was, you know, as happy as he possibly could be. And then eventually, he started having health problems again another 6 to 9 months later. And he was determined he had colon cancer. And he was admitted to the hospital mid-1981 and to have a colon resection done. So obviously the smoking caught up with him and all the you know, bad stuff that can cause.
So what do you think about your father being a World War II veteran?
You know, I'm very proud of him, obviously, for going to serve and especially, you know, enlisting and basically trying to help. You know, when he obviously got the Purple Heart and great that he was able to do it. Obviously, it caused him a lot of pain and I would say the family a lot of pain with, you know, how he was, you know, kind of in pain and not treating us all that well because of his war injuries. But all in all, you know, I'm proud of the guy. And even though he's a very quiet man, he, you know, was a good man overall.
Right. And perhaps you have any you have a favorite story that your dad has told you?
Well, I guess during this time when he was even before he had the successful surgery, during this time he ended up giving up smoking for a period of time. And we all couldn't believe it because he was always so addicted to it. And he was so, you know, it gave him so much, you know, I guess, pleasure. So he quit and, you know, it was great. Everybody was happy about it. But then eventually he came home one day and said he had this big box in the car. And he was used to work evenings at that point. So he came home like at 2 o'clock in the afternoon from shopping and had me help him bring this big box down to the basement. So he started opening up this box and it turned out to be a radial arm saw, like this big saw with a, you know, kind of a table and a big saw on the top of it. And he's kind of a handyman, so he loved using this thing. So we started putting it together and all of a sudden he went over to his workbench and lit up a cigarette. And this is probably, you know, 4 to 5 months after he had stopped smoking. And I was like, "Dad, what, you know, what are you doing? What, why did you, you know, why are you starting to smoke again?" And he goes, "Well, you know, this saw costs $357 and your mother never would have let me buy it if I didn't save money somewhere." So he basically showed me this little drawing on his little pad of paper that he had where he figured out that a pack of cigarettes was 30 cents a pack or whatever it was, so he gave up, you know, X amount of packs for so many days exactly before he went out and bought his saw that he could, you know, start using for fun and for building stuff. So that's the kind of guy he was. He would just, you know, gave up something that he really liked for the exact number of days and went right back to it. So that's kind of a real descriptive story about who he was and you know, kind of how he led his life. Turns out when he went into that colon surgery back in 1981, during the surgery, he ended up having several small strokes and kind of blockages of blood in the brain. So during the surgery, he never really came out of it. He went into a coma and he was basically in a coma for almost a month where my mom would drive like 30 miles every day to see him and sit there with him. And he ended up, you know, never really gaining consciousness again. He eventually, you know, passed away in June 6th of 1981. And he was buried in a local cemetery there in McHenry. And interesting that at some point, when I was probably in my mid-40s, I ended up having the same surgery he had because of I had some cancerous colon issues myself, but mine worked out fine. My surgery went fine, so it was just kind of a interesting correlation. But he was a special guy. He again was very quiet, very unassuming, determined, diligent, disciplined. But eventually, you know, in part due to the surgery or the injury he suffered during the war, he was challenged by getting back into life and dealing with it. But I'm still proud of him.